In 2005, Richard Louv coined the term nature deficit disorder. It's a phrase that has resonated with millions of people all around the world. Now he's working hard to bring all of us back to the woods. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Richard Louv is the best-selling author of Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle. These days, he focuses his energy on helping people understand why it's so important for children to connect with nature. And he's also helped many adults get outdoors and reconnect to get their daily dose of vitamin N. He'll be in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday for the Our Woodland Legacy Symposium, sponsored by Trees Forever. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When Richard Louv's book, Last Child in the Woods, came out in 2005, he managed to put into words something that a lot of people were worried about, a disconnect between children and nature. He introduced the term nature deficit disorder, and he really galvanized a movement. Since then, he's written The Nature Principle and also founded the Children and Nature Network. He'll be in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday for the Our Woodland Legacy Symposium, sponsored by Trees Forever, and he is with me now. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you.
Well, let's go back to
being there in person.
Yeah, that would be even better. But let's go back to before 2005, when you started writing the book Last Child in the Woods. What did you see around you that made you take action and start doing research?
Well, actually, I was researching an earlier book called Childhood Future in the late 1980s, and I was spending a lot of time in classrooms and in living rooms around the country. I interviewed about 3,000 parents and kids for that book, which was about the changing realities of family life. And what I was looking for is not what the conference table was telling us, but what the kitchen table was telling us. And I looked for the repeating themes in these groups. Of these 3,000 folks. And one of them that kept popping up, particularly with parents, but even with kids to a degree, was this discomfort. Something was changing with the relationship between children and nature. They just weren't going outside very much, particularly in the nature, or certainly to soccer, et cetera. So I wrote a chapter about that in that book called The Nature of Childhood that got picked up and run in various places. And that was anecdotal evidence, though. But over the next 10 years or 15 years research started showing up, really interesting research, not only about the deficit, about the disconnect between children and nature, but about the benefits, which to me was even more important. That news was beginning to show up. So at that point, I had a book to write that wasn't just anecdotal.
Well, and let's talk about when you started looking at the benefits, because you did coin this term, nature deficit disorder, and that's not a medical term. It's shorthand for this idea that children are not spending enough time in nature and are feeling disconnected from the natural world, although that's something that they couldn't probably put into words. But there are, from the research that many people have done and the research that you pulled together, there are a lot of very real ways that time spent in nature affects our health.
Well, that's true. And by the way, kids are pretty articulate about this, surprisingly, including the kids that don't get outside very much. I mean, early on, particularly middle school kids, which are the best kids to quote for some reason, they would talk about watching television, watching old shows like Lassie. Except one kid said that looked like people living on Mars to him. It was so unfamiliar. And, one boy said the reason he plays indoors is because that's where all the electrical outlets are. So they have more of a sense of this than maybe it would seem. The parents were obviously more tuned into it. In terms of the benefits, one of the people who's going to be at this symposium I'm going to be at and speaking at in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday is Dr. Bill Sullivan, who took part in some very, very important research done at the University of Illinois about attention deficit disorder, and the symptoms of attention deficit disorder being reduced significantly with just a little bit of contact with nature. Also, research was done there about urban places that have more trees and have more green, more nature, are safer than places that don't. Not in every case, but in many cases, that's true in terms of urban parks. That may have to do, by the way, with the fact that these green, beautiful places draw good people to them. And so there's a better mix of folks in those places. But in any case, this research, some of which was done at the University of Illinois by Bill Sullivan, is extraordinarily important. And it runs the gamut now from the symptoms of attention deficit disorder to myopia. Research in Australia links not going outside very much to the drastic rise in myopia in Australia and probably elsewhere. Cognitive functioning gets better with just a little bit of contact with nature. If we really want to improve our schools, we will get kids outdoors more. I mean, in Finland, which leads the world in science and math testing, kids there spend 45 minutes in class, 15 minutes outside, preferably in nature, 45 in class, 15 in nature all day. Meanwhile, we are busy canceling or cutting back on recess. So in many ways, we're going in the opposite direction. But this research is, I think, fascinating, obviously, to me. But it's not only about kids, it's about adults, too. And the second book, The Nature Principle, was more about adults than it was kids.
Well, and when you published Last Child in the Woods, did you find that a lot of adults were coming to you and saying, hey, this isn't just about kids?
They did, in effect. After it came out, I obviously gave a lot of speeches in a lot of places and still do. And I remember one woman in Seattle, I was signing books, and she came up to me at the signing table, and she literally grabbed me by the lapels and kind of pulled me up and said, listen to me. Adults have major deficit disorder too. You got to write a book about that. And I said, let me go. they said that a lot. And that is part of where the Nature Principle came from, the second book. The other reason for the Nature Principle is that I often say that, Martin Luther King said and demonstrated in many ways that any culture, certainly any movement, will fail if it cannot paint a picture of a world that people will want to go to. And I think that that world is not only a sustainable world, it's a nature-rich world. We've got to start describing that. Nature-rich cities, nature-rich homes, nature-rich schools. And so part of the reason for the Nature Principle is within the limits of my abilities to try to describe, paint a picture of what that world might be.
When those adults collared you and said, hey, this is about adults too, were they talking about themselves? Were they saying, I feel disconnected from nature?
Yes. Yeah.
And so when people said that to you, I can imagine some people might think, well, then go outside. So what was your response?
I would say that to myself all the time. Yeah, it's not easy. I mean, I we are surrounded by electronics. We're immersed in it. You and I are immersed in it right now. And that's a good thing. I mean, I'm not anti-tech, but it has become so much part of the environment. It's like the curtains. It's like the carpet under our feet. It's everywhere. It's hard to get away from. And it's constantly competing for our attention, and we're working longer hours. There are a lot of pressures on adults, and parents in particular, as well as kids. So I'm very careful not to judge parents, for instance. Often I'll hear from people, well, it's the parents' fault. The parents they're responsible. And yeah, what else is new? And of course, but so are schools. So is the workplace. So is the bad urban design that so many cities have. That, we preach to families, go outside and take a walk. Walk where in some of these neighborhoods? So in terms of the fear that parents feel, accurately or not, and often it's not accurate, it's because of our profession of journalism, in part of electronic journalism, print journalism, You know, you look at the number of actual crimes by strangers against kids, and it's been going down for at least 30 years. But our perception of that fear has been going up, and that's because of the 24-hour news cycle. So we really have to put, you know, the responsibility of parents in that context. They need nature, too. We all do. I do. I struggle to get away from it, too. My wife and I go on what we call techno-fast. We leave all the electronics behind, and we go up in the mountains and rent a cabin for a few days just to recenter ourselves. So this is a challenge for everybody today.
Well, let's talk about some of the barriers to spending time in nature. And of course, you've mentioned technology and screens. Kids that you talk to mention that you play inside because that's where all the outlets are. And screens tend to be demonized in our society for making kids sit still and keeping them indoors. How much of a problem do you think all of this access to technology is?
Well, it all depends on how we use it, of course, and that's a cliche, but it's true. In the nature principle, I have a phrase that I use quite a bit, which is the more high-tech our lives become, the more nature we need. It's kind of an equation. If we start applying that to our homes, the way they're built, what our backyard looks like, our schools, what they're like, or even our workplace, if we begin to incorporate more nature into our lives, that offsets some of the negative impacts of technology. And I don't demonize technology either. I'm pretty dependent on it. But it's really in many ways gotten way out of balance. If we look at schools, for instance, what's coming down the pike, some of this we're happy when we heard that No Child Left Behind looked like it was going to be left behind, and it probably will. That approach to education, which is nonstop testing in a sense, and it has some good qualities, but it's been very problematic for a lot of kids and a lot of teachers. But what's coming now is, if you look at it closely, there's a great series in the Washington, Monthly on this. What's coming now, along with national core standards, on which I'm an agnostic, but what's coming now is the way that this will be implemented in the classroom will be largely electronic. But the people in charge of that debate right now, which is not being held very much in public, because the public, I'm not sure, cares in some sense or knows about it. But what's coming is more and more video games in the classroom as teaching tools, more and more computers. What the proponents of this approach call, with no embarrassment, stealth monitoring. It's some of the same technology that's used in grocery stores to track produce, to tell what's on the shelves. The good news is that testing as we know it will fade away.
And Richard, we have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're also going to try to reconnect and get a better phone line, better phone connection in just a moment. I'm talking with Richard Louv. He's the best-selling author of Last Child in the Woods and also The Nature Principle. He'll be in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Richard Louv. He's the best-selling author of the books Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle. He is also the founder of the Children and Nature Network, and he will be in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday for the Our Woodland Legacy Symposium, sponsored by Trees Forever. And this hour, we're talking about the connection between kids and nature and the connection between adults and nature as well. You're welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. And Richard, before the break, we were talking about screen time, which gets a lot of the blame for keeping kids inside and keeping kids inactive. And you were talking about some of the really innovative ways that technology can be used in schools to free kids up from filling in the little circles on the standardized tests that are so common. So screen time can be incredibly valuable. You're saying it's just that we're doing too much of it?
Well, it's out of balance. And before the break, I was talking about how the good news is with the changes coming, more technology in the classrooms, because of what is called stealth stealth monitoring. Testing, as we know it, the paper tests will fade away. The not so good news, to me at least, is that we won't need that because the machines will be watching kids all the time. Every keystroke they make will be watched. And every video game they play in the classroom will be watched. The problem isn't the presence of technology, because that has some great benefits, obviously. The problem is the absence of so much experience in the real world, particularly in nature. If we can find a balance, we'll be okay. One of the things I like to repeat is I think there should be a new mantra for every state legislator and every school administrator, which is, for every dollar we spend on the virtual in education, we should spend another dollar on the real, particularly nature. If we do that, kids will be just fine.
Okay, so you also have mentioned a couple of the other barriers that we face in our society. You mentioned the lack of walkable communities, so it's difficult to send kids out to go for a walk when there are no sidewalks for them to walk on. And you also mentioned stranger danger. So obviously our fear of bad things happening to kids has affected the way that the freedoms that we give our kids. You feel like we as a society have really overreacted?
Again, this is understandable. I mean, there's some people who would like to shame parents for being so scared, and I'm not one of them, because I had that same fear as a parent when my wife and I were raising our boys. And I knew it was irrational because I'd seen the real statistics. But the real statistics aren't convincing. You know, when you're surrounded by these messages all the time coming at you from every direction, that it's getting more dangerous out there. Some neighborhoods it is. But most neighborhoods, it's actually safer than it was 30 years ago. So it's the perception that is the problem. Now, having said that, just preaching to parents that it's not, you know, it's safer out there than you know, isn't going to be that helpful. I think that we're going to have to come up with new ways to connect our kids and ourselves with nature. One of those ways, for instance, is family nature clubs. A few years ago, a second grade teacher and father of young kids emailed me and said that he and his wife had been inspired by Last Child in the Woods, and they started getting their kids and themselves out to the park on Saturdays. And one day the five-year-old says, "Dad, how come we're the only family having this much fun?" So he started inviting other families. Now they have probably about 1,000 families on their email list. There are a lot of these clubs that have sprung up around the country in which multiple families agree to show up at the park on Saturday. Not 1,000 families, but out of that 1,000 families, 4 or 5 will agree to go gardening next Sunday or next Saturday or do something else outside together. That gives the sense of safety because there's perceived safety in numbers. It's also great for building our social networks as adults. It's great for the kids, and you would think that, well, that isn't exactly unstructured time in nature. But in truth, the way it works is these parents have reported to us that if they take their kids, just their kids, out for a hike, the kids are kind of clingy and want to get back to the video games and all of that. But if they take their kids with them with other families that have kids, the kids are off running, playing hide-and-seek, doing what kids have done for millennia, and they're making up their own rules, which, by the way, is one of the most important things about play. And that, along with experience of nature, is fading in children's lives. Their sense of independent, make-believe play in which they make up their own rules. It has everything to do with executive function and creativity.
When we send our kids outside to play, we have created these amazing play structures on playgrounds and even in our backyards. When you send kids out and they spend their time crawling through plastic tubes, does that still count? Is that time spent in nature?
I don't think that's nature. Scientists have problem defining nature, and it's one of the reasons why there's been so relatively little research on this, is because they have trouble with that definition. So lots of things, if you get very literal about it, can be called nature. But I think we know it when we see it. And climbing through tubes at a fast food restaurant, I don't think that necessarily counts. Even soccer on a green field, I don't think necessarily counts. My
personal definition of nature is anywhere I'm in meaningful contact with species other than my own. And and that can be a backyard, that can be in an urban place, it can be in a rural place, in a suburban place. That kind of nature has different qualities, and that's what some of the studies are showing, is that there's something about being in a more natural environment that gives us something that we don't get elsewhere. One example, for instance, is research on adults. Two groups of adults, one on treadmills, indoor gyms, the other group expending the same number of calories but doing it outdoors in green exercise. Both groups get healthier, blood pressure, psychological health, but the people burning the same number of calories in nature get even better. There's a margin of improvement there that we really don't understand. And I think that goes deep into our humanity of who we are as biological and even spiritual creatures.
When your first, or well, not your first book, but when when Last Child in the Woods came out, as I mentioned before, it really resonated with a lot of people, and it sparked a lot of other people to write about the same thing and also to make documentaries and really make changes in their own lives with their kids, changes as far as opening new nature-based preschools. And I mean, some really exciting things have happened. In some of the media that I've seen surrounding this issue, one of the things that struck me as a person who grew up in nature and spent a lot of time outside playing in the dirt and playing in a creek and making mud pies and doing all of that, was that a lot of the families that were sort of held up as examples had their children do nature journals and I mean, some really neat stuff. But part of me said, wait a minute, I felt like in some ways they were creating more barriers, because just getting dirty and having fun seems like the point, instead of, you know, creating your own journal about the plants that you see. How do you feel when you see things like that?
Well, it's a great point. And one of the one of the paradoxes that runs throughout this issue, and certainly runs throughout both Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle, is that in order to give our kids and ourselves some semblance of unstructured experience in nature, we're probably going to have to structure a lot of it. And and a lot of that is because of the fear that parents feel. It's a lot of it is because of the other pressures in our lives. And it's just something we're going to have to learn to do, and do with a sense of humor. Many of the nature centers have figured out, for instance, how to get kids outdoors. And yes, they structure that experience, but they give kids sit spaces, places where they can sit and just be there. Don't have to do anything. Beyond that, though, this is a very good point, that the optimum experience here is not about information. Kids get a lot of information about nature. The optimum point here is about experiencing nature with as many senses as you can. The scientists who look at the human senses no longer talk about five senses. They talk conservatively about 10 senses, and some scientists talk about as many as 30 or more human senses, and they all have names, these senses. We spend most of our lives, most of our days, many of us, looking at screens, no matter what age we are, trying to block out as many senses as we can so we can focus on that screen and allegedly go anywhere we want in the world through the internet. If we're spending that much energy blocking out our senses, if our kids are doing that, that to me is the very definition of being less alive. None of us, I don't think, want our kids to be less alive, nor do we ourselves want to be less alive, most of us at least. And so part of the focus here has to be on simply feeling alive. It's, again, that goes beyond the information. That goes beyond journaling, or goes beyond environmental education or learning about recycling or natural systems. It's simply being alive. And it turns out that some of the studies have shown that the very burnout that we feel when we spend too much time in directed attention, often on computers, that burnout can be balanced by using a different kind of attention. And it turns out that kind of attention uses different parts of the brain, and it tends to happen when we're in the natural world, even if it's a backyard. And so that kind of thing is best done in an unstructured way. But you may have to structure some activities in order to even get to that point in which you do allow a kid to dig a hole just for the joy of it.
Well, and with kids, there are other barriers to getting them to go outside, even when you think, all right, they need to have unstructured playtime outside. As a parent, I found that telling my children that they didn't have to put on their shoes was a good way to actually get them out the door. I mean, it feels like there are just so many little things that stand in our way.
Well, it's very true. And schools, you're right, there's a big growth in nature preschools, and there's even a growth in charter schools and high schools that are dedicated to nature. That is happening. But many schools still are a big part of the problem. And in some ways, that problem is growing in terms of the barriers. And it has to do in part with the devaluing of the nature experience. You know, unless you can turn it into, in the higher education, it's no longer publish or perish, it's patent or perish. And that is often has to do with patenting biomedical products, genetic engineering, et cetera. So the traditional biology approach to biology of actually going out and looking at things and tracking them and naming them and being aware of what's around us, that has given way to a laboratory-based kind of biology. There's a guy named Paul Dayton who's a oceanographer, very famous oceanographer at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego, where I live. And he's very upset with the way that higher education is going in terms of pushing out biology. He worries that people aren't going to be around in anywhere near the numbers that we need them, that will actually know what's out there, that will be able to name it, that will be able to notice if it's missing. And one day I asked him, well, Paul, there's a charter high school right up the hill at University of California, San Diego. And they bring in inner city kids to that charter high school. Why don't you go up to that high school and offer to take those kids out on the Scripps Institution boats, ships, the Explorer, and out on the famous pier and to learn about oceanography and get their hands wet doing that. And he said, with great patience, well, Rich, I tried exactly that. I went up and I talked to the administrator up there. The administrator said, Dr. Dayton, we've become so sophisticated at teaching biology that our kids don't have to go outside anymore. So, you know, these barriers are everywhere. And part of the focus of this movement that really has emerged, and part of the focus of the Children and Nature Network, which is a nonprofit that grew out of these books, is really to try to bring down those barriers. And there are a lot of them. It's not just technology. I don't just demonize technology. It's all these others, too. So, you know, that's our focus, is to bring down those barriers as best we can.
I'm talking with Richard Louvre. He is the best-selling author of Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle. He's also the founder of the Children and Nature Network, and he'll be in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday for the Our Woodland Legacy Symposium. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Danielle is on the line in Woodward. Hi, Danielle.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I've heard your guest speak. I have been a naturalist professionally since 1976. I've been a federal park ranger. I've worked as a state-level environmental educator, and now I teach at the college level. I'm wondering if, Richard, have you heard of the book The Ecology of Imagination in Early Childhood by Edith Cobb, a contemporary of Margaret Mead? She talks about children needing these unstructured, maybe even not very much supervised experiences in the natural world in order to really become human, and how children able to explore those outdoor environments actually achieve something she would liken to unity with the natural world.
I have. And Edith Cobb is very important. I write about her and her work in Last Child in the Woods. And a woman who is a wonderful interpreter of her work is Louise Chawa at the University of Colorado. And interestingly, Cobb was not a scientist, and she got criticized in her time for her methodology. But the research that is based on science that has come out since really underscores that she was onto something. One of the things that I think that we need to do is to extend the argument that she makes to include technology. I think in terms of what I call the hybrid mind, I write about this in the Nature Principle. Mm-hmm. The best way to describe that is I met a guy who teaches people how to be the pilots of cruise ships. We need a few good ones. And he said he gets two kinds of students. One kind of student grew up in front of TVs and computers. He said that kind of student, I need their talent. They know a lot about electronics, got a lot of electronics on the ships. The other kind of student I get grew up more outside, hiking or farming, et cetera. He said that kind of student also has a talent I need. That kind of student actually knows where the ship is. And he wasn't being facetious. He was being literal. I mean, the full use of the senses, which are often stunted when we don't go outside. So he said his optimum student would be a student who has both sets of skills, both the virtual and the real. And I think that is where the future of creativity in our schools is certainly going to be.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Richard Louv. He's the best-selling author of Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle. And you're welcome to join our conversation. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. And this hour, we're talking about our connection with the natural world and why it's so vital to all human beings. My guest is best-selling author Richard Louv. He's the author of Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle. He's also the founder of the Children and Nature Network. And he will be in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday for the Our Woodland Legacy Symposium sponsored by Trees Forever. You can find out more information about that symposium at our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. And you are also welcome to join our conversation with your questions this hour. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can post questions on our Facebook page. And Richard, we were talking earlier about how after you wrote that first book, Last Child in the Woods, a lot of adults were coming to you and saying, this isn't just about kids. And in The Nature Principle, you write about a very sad event in your life, and that's that your father took his own life. And you believe there may have been a connection there of his disconnect with the natural world.
Well, I wrote about that in The Nature Principle as a kind of confession that I have a bias. I want to be honest that I look at the world in a certain way. And I don't pretend to be a scientist. I mean, I quote a lot of scientists, but this comes from, personal experience that I started when I was first aware that I was here on Earth. And my father was a wonderful father in my early years, and when I was a small kid, and spent a lot of time with me and my brother and my mother outside in the garden, gardening or fishing or walking in the woods through the snow outside of Kansas City. I loved that time. That was the perfect time. And I saw that my family was happiest outdoors, happiest doing those things. My father had a mental illness and had other issues later. And these progressed over time. And as I saw him worsening, I saw him also withdrawing from nature. His dream had been to retire to the Ozarks and someday and fish all day. By the time he retired, and in fact they got a little house on Table Rock Lake in the Ozarks, he no longer left the kitchen table. He did not go fishing, and he had a sad ending. Now, I associate health, therefore, mental health and physical health, with being outdoors. So that's why I told that story in the book. And I interview an eco psychologist in the book, a very wonderful woman, And I asked her, what would have happened if my father had gotten nature therapy? I mean, I used to pray as a little kid that he would stop being a chemical engineer and start being a forest ranger, because I thought that would make him happy. And I asked her, what would have happened if at that time, if psychiatry and psychology had actually involved nature therapy, which some psychologists are now doing, some psychiatrists are even now doing, would that have helped? And she said she didn't know, but it would have helped the rest of the family, for sure. I mean, you might have had him a little longer. So I don't claim that it would have cured him. I don't know that, but it would have helped all of us. And I think about all the other families out there that are under such stress, and they don't have to have a serious mental illness in the family to understand what I'm talking about, I don't think.
You mentioned that sometimes you struggle with having enough time in nature. What are the signs? When do you start noticing that, wait, I've spent too much time at the computer screen, I really need to get out there?
I get a little squirrely. I mean, I don't know how you feel when you spend too much time indoors, but you need to get out there. And you have to make a conscious decision to do it. And
but I guess, you know, yeah, for you, that feeling is something you recognize as, I need to go outside. But mm-hmm. for a lot of people, I would guess that that's not what that feeling makes them think.
No, and it has to do with the way the culture thinks, I think. You know, right now, nature time is not considered an enrichment, for instance, in kids' development. Parents consider Suzuki violin lessons an enrichment, but not going outside and having your senses stimulated and having your psychological health improved and all of that in nature. That's not yet on the list of enrichments. And it's not on the list of enrichments for most adults either. But I think that the more that all of us know about this new research, and the more all of us are aware, simply become aware of what's happening in our surroundings, the more we will value nature. I see that happening already. I mean, in the medical world, for instance, I was the keynote speaker in 2010 to the American Academy of Pediatrics and talked to about 5,000 pediatricians. And the reception was extremely good, to my surprise and pleasure. It was, and this is an incredibly important group because parents trust them. And today, not because of that speech, but because of a lot of other things, many pediatricians are now beginning to prescribe nature to the families or recommend it to parents of kids. In Portland, the urban park district there is working with local physicians who are recommending nature to their patients, and the park folks are calling those families when they get home saying, here's what we can do for you. And then the park rangers acting as health paraprofessionals, park health paraprofessionals, a new role that they really like, are helping these families get their green exercise. So I think that this is beginning to enter the culture in new ways. And as it does, that awareness that we will feel better and be psychologically better off and be physically better off if we get outside in nature, that there's something special about that, I think more and more of us will begin to think that way.
I'm talking with Richard Louv, the best-selling author of Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle, and you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Elizabeth is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I am listening to the program. And because I actually got put on second shift this week, yay, I get to be outside a little bit. And I just totally agree with everything your gentleman is saying. I mean, I give it like two thumbs up. I'm one of those people as an adult who suffers greatly if I am not outside for a while. And I totally understand what he is saying about kids need to being outside, like in the woods, in the parks, playing.
So what do you do when you need to get outside, Elizabeth?
I'm one of those people that actually likes doing yard work. I even like shoveling snow. People are like, are you nuts? And I find I mentally suffer if I do not get to be out in the elements. When I get stuck on first shift, I don't get to pick my shift. I suffer inside to such a horrible degree. It's awful.
Oh. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for calling. And, you know, what Elizabeth is talking about and what you're talking about, Richard, there are so many different health issues that are so interconnected in what you're talking about with nature deficit disorder. And Elizabeth certainly brings up a very good point that for a lot of people, the hours that they work really interfere with their ability to get outside or to get enough sleep or to see daylight.
Absolutely. And that can't be minimized. I mean, I think it's clear now. I don't preach at people that they should do something. And I think that we need to help each other do things. And, you know, one of the sponsor of the, you know, the speech that I'm giving on Wednesday is Trees Forever, which is doing great work in Iowa. And its work illustrates an aspect of this, which is we've really got to look at our physical environment, the environment of our yards, environment of the parks, environment of our cities, of our workplaces, of our schools. And, you know, Trees Forever has been planting thousands of trees with thousands of community volunteers who not only trees, but native plants and prairies and other natural areas. That's, in a sense, creating nature. It goes beyond our usual definition of sustainability, which is basically understood by most people to be about energy efficiency. As of 2008, more people live in cities in the world, whole world, than in the countryside. First time in human history. Huge moment in human history. That means one of two things. Either the connection that human beings have to nature will gradually disappear or fade to the inconsequential, or it means the beginning of a new kind of city. And in Iowa, I know that there's not a lot of wilderness and there's a lot of farmland, but people mainly live in cities in Iowa, and so those cities can change. They can become more natural. Even the inner cities can become, you know, you can have green roofs and yards and all kinds of features through design that actually bring back butterfly migration routes and bird migration routes, that cities can actually be engines of biodiversity. Urban parks that have the highest degree of biodiversity also have been shown to be the parks that have the best impact on human psychological health. So if we begin to imagine and paint a picture of a different kind of future, not just sustainable, but nature-rich, it's a different future. One of the things that I'm concerned about more and more is I think we've got to be really careful how we talk to our kids about the future and how we talk to ourselves. I've become convinced that most Americans carry around images of the far future that are dominant images. And that future looks a lot like Blade Runner or Mad Max or at best The Hunger Games if it has a little nature in it. And if those images are not balanced by other images in our minds as a culture that are images rich in nature and rich in health, then we will surely get that post-apocalyptic image, that post-apocalyptic future that we think we're going to get. The number one selling genre in young adult fiction today is called dystopic fiction. It's about this post-apocalyptic world in which not even vampires are having a good time. We've got to have different images in our minds. And I think that's one of the exciting things, Trees Forever. Lots of organizations are out there doing it, but they're really not naming it yet. And I've called this the new nature movement that includes environmentalism, traditional sustainability, but goes beyond that. It really is about creating something better, not just something survivable, but something wonderful.
Thea, in talking about the kind of future we imagine in fiction is one thing, but something that I've observed in a lot of environmental education, we also paint a very, very frightening picture of the future that we're showing our kids. And a lot of environmental education focuses on this is what's happening to polar bears. And, you know, this is what's happening to the ice cap. A very frightening image. And I wonder if sometimes when kids are taught about those things, if the response isn't to love nature and want to protect it, but this feeling of helplessness and hopelessness.
I think it is. And I think the environmental organizations understand this at the highest level. I mean, I know the heads of many of the major national environmental organizations. They see their own membership aging out. I mean, one of the biggest environmental organizations, the average age is 78 of members. And they're quite worried about that. They're quite worried about their lack of diversity, about the aging. But one of the things they have yet to come to grips with is that if you hand people a plate of despair and expect them to eat it and to feel better, you know, that's not a way to create a better world. I mean, I'm not saying for a second that we should just tell happy news for happy news' sake. My roots are in journalism, and I'm allergic to that. But I am saying that in the civil rights period, for instance, they never quit talking about the bad news at all about civil rights. But what they did is that they also talked about this dream. It wasn't called I Have a Nightmare. It was called I Have a Dream. And they could, and Martin Luther King painted that picture in people's minds that someday it would be better, not just adequate, but better. And it seems to me that environmentalism, a new environmentalism, has to begin to do that. One of the things we can do is start in our own backyards. One of the things I'd like to see happen is a homegrown national park in which people all over the country, kids, parents, replant their yards in native species and help bring back butterfly migration routes and really increase the biodiversity where they live. Think of the power kids would feel if they were part of that, in addition to hearing the bad news, but if they were creating nature, not just mourning for it.
Do you feel more optimistic about the future than you did in 2005?
I don't see how I could help but feel that because of so many good things have happened beyond what any of us thought. But at the same time, those barriers, some of them are growing. We can't assume this is finished at all. It's just beginning.
Richard Louv, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you.
And if you have one piece of advice for the grown-ups listening right now who maybe haven't thought about themselves as having nature deficit disorder, but maybe are starting to think about it, do you have one piece of advice for grown-ups who are not worried about their kids connecting with nature but may need to think about themselves?
Well, I'll share advice I gave myself at the beginning of the summer. I realized I was getting overweight, too many airplanes, and too much, you know, luncheon food. And I was getting a little down and stressed and all that. And so I suddenly had this realization that the days I spent, if I spend most of the day on a hike or taking pictures in nature, my digital camera, or fishing, if I do any one of those three things during a day, I tend to be, I don't get depressed, I tend not to ruminate, I don't worry as much, and I sleep better at night. And I came up with this kind of obvious equation is, what if I did that or tried to do that 2 days a week all summer? And I did that, and believe me, things got better. I lost 15 pounds. I feel a whole lot better. I call it my Dr. Fishmore diet.
Richard Louv, thanks again.
All right, thank you.
Richard Louv is the best-selling author of Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle. He founded the Children in Nature Network, and he will be in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday as part of the Our Woodland Legacy Symposium sponsored by Trees Forever. You can find out more about that symposium on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, I'll talk with author Mitch Albom and one of Santa's most dedicated helpers. This is Talk of Iowa.